Today on Talk About That, John has a smelly dog and a go-kart. Meanwhile, I fracture a toe and ponder the role of a professional sweetener. Plus, a conversation about biblical interpretations and how we tend to view what we read through the lenses of our culture and biases. Today's episode is not sponsored by the C-Pup Machine. Got a snoring dog? Try C-Pup. Let's go.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
It's your favorite time of the week, Johnny. It's Talk About That.
I don't think you know a lot about my week.
Like, this is not even in the top 10.
Oh, of course it is, John. It's always great to see you.
It's good to see you as well. You may notice that I have now assumed winter attire. For those of you who are watching,
I think we need to show people that we're in the same room. Why don't you take something from your desk and throw it to me?
You don't think they know?
Yeah, I just want to show that, like, we're split screen, but yeah, like, we're... See, look at that.
Look at that. I'm glad I caught that because my headphones are inside. I kept waiting for it to just explode.
Yeah.
How's it going, man? How you doing?
I'm all right. It's fine.
I'm really digging your background today.
I decided to give a little love to my buddy, John Driver, author extraordinaire.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the ultimate guide to the avid endorsement is behind me if you're not watching this on video. And if you're not, why aren't you?
Apparently, according to the book, it won an award or something.
Is that on the book now?
Do you not see it right behind you?
Uh-uh.
You don't see this?
I just put whatever book behind me.
You don't
told
see the
me
sticker
to.
That says...
winner of the Silver Schmopty Schmoop?
What was that? Award? Best Book Award, I think is what it was.
That's what they call it?
Yeah.
The Best Book Award? What a dull
title. It was American Book Fest, I think, is the one.
I won the Bronze Crown Award for Best Comedy when my Franklin Theater special was nominated for I think it's called IVCM.
Yeah.
The International...
Everyone knows about that.
Christian Video Media. Anyway. And the Bronze Crown Award means I placed third.
Hey, that's good.
But it's the Bronze Crown. If you win the crown, I think it's called the Gold Crown, and you get the silver. Anyway, we're going to throw them all at
Jesus'
feet.
We're going to say, they literally are a Christian company named after
I think
the
when
theme.
I go to throw the Bronze Crown at Jesus' feet, he's going to be like, I'm good.
You can keep it.
You know, it's just a piece of paper.
Not sure this really honors
me. It was fine to put it on your wall.
Right.
If you ever took pride in that, that would have been a real mistake on your part. No, it was fine. It was an honor to win it. It was an honor just to be nominated,
oh,
honestly.
Oh, my goodness.
But, no, congratulations on all your success, John. We're very proud of you over here.
Yeah, I am a struggling writer. So
you're
we
not
should call
struggling.
It, no, we should call it like it is. Things are a little, like, I'm writing a lot right now, but not...
No one's reading
no
it?
No one's reading it or paying me for it.
Oh.
So I'm a real writer right now.
Oh, yeah.
There's things I'm working on that, I don't know, it's been an interesting year in that respect.
I think what you're doing is putting together a manifesto. What is that? I'm writing a lot, and I'm just waiting for my moment in history. You're like, okay, this feels weird.
I'm assembling a team of minions.
Till the time is right.
Right.
It's weird.
For the motherland.
Yeah. You'll be fine.
I was watching that episode of where Dwight makes the speech, the salesman speech.
Oh, and he pounds on the podium?
Yeah. Have you watched the...
Jim gives him the Mussolini speech or whatever?
Yeah. Like the Ultimate Fan episodes, they're extended cuts. Have you watched them?
No.
Yeah, there's extra scenes they cut. And not a lot.
It's awkward anyway.
Oh,
that whole scene is awkward anyway, but...
Yeah. But it's so funny how they all just... salesman of the greater Northern Pennsylvania area, unite! Like, it's all... Yeah. He just inserts, you know.
Yeah, it's true. If you speak with authority, I think that's kind of what the point of that was. You speak with authority, you can, it resonates. Eventually, you win them over, which is also terrifying.
Right. Oh, it absolutely is. Well, I try not to be an axiomatic, like, leader or speaker as much.
I don't know what that is, John. No, I know what axiomatic is.
Like, I try not to just, because I'm a real, like, coin a phrase kind of guy, you know? When I was young, I've been really pondering this a lot lately. Like, because I want to write a book. I'm not going to tell you the title, but it's a great title. It reminds me, actually, of Michael Scott's book title. He could never get the book written.
Somehow I managed.
It's a great title, you know. Mine's like that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you off air, but I don't want someone to steal it.
Oh, that's true. Know? It could happen because we have.
Right, because, you know, that's going to happen. But it's about hope, and it's about, like, and I was talking to someone yesterday and reading through, like, every story in the Bible, every writer from C.S. Lewis to anyone else that you read, they all go through this, like, dark night of the soul.
Yeah.
You know, and I started thinking about how many things I tried to write about in my early 20s, late 20s, even early 30s, that now I would not want to read myself.
Yeah.
Because it's not an age thing, I think, or even just an experience thing, but it would be, you know, the equivalent of me writing a book on playing the mandolin. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I know a few chords, but I have a friend, you and I have a friend who has a master's degree in bluegrass performance, and he literally does stuff on the mandolin that I can't even imagine can be done. Like, I want to know, if I don't know about the mandolin, I want to ask him because he's actually experienced it on that level. But, like, you don't want to hear a book on getting through suffering from some dude who's 21, who's won his whole life, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can be young and have that level, but I don't know. I'm kind of at that place to go, I feel like all the stuff from my past that I wrote about, you know, and one of the axioms I came up with for leaders back then was on speaking, like, hey, the most important thing about being a speaker, to your point of just being able to, you know, pound the table, most important thing about being a speaker to me is actually having something to say.
Yeah.
I still stick by that axiom. But I think I wrote that in my mid-20s, but I still think that's key.
Yeah, I mean, when I started doing comedy, and then I started meeting people, and you're always meeting people, and I still do, meeting people who are trying to get into comedy, or they're young at comedy, but they are kind of, they're not getting the amount of work that they think they deserve yet, and they're like, they're asking you questions like, how do I get more shows? But then somewhere the questions, if you're not careful, can start dialing into, like, what did you do? How did you get where you are? And how can I skip line to get to where you are? And it's almost like you're trying to figure out, as a young comic, how to trick somebody into thinking you're a level ahead of where you are. And then you hope that you're big enough for that moment when you get there.
Right.
Instead of, like, actually being undeniably good and then hoping that success will follow. I think it's because we see so many people not get rewarded for their success, or we see people get rewarded for success they didn't deserve.
Yeah.
And so it builds in this weird system in our head where we're like, all right, I'm going to use in some of these tricks, but when I get my sizzle reel together, that's like my best 2 minutes to try to fake it until I get in the moment. When I get there, though, I'll be as big as the moment.
Uh-huh.
I won't blow it. And sometimes you just don't get opportunities because you're not ready. It's hard to admit that to yourself.
Do you ever feel that there's a chance you won't be as big as the moment?
Yes.
I mean, because I do, too.
Sometimes you just feel like I'm not a fit. It's not a matter of... I give myself a break on most things these days. I go, well, this was not a fit. This was a bad idea. I do some events where I get there and they go, hey, we're going to do this and blah, blah, blah. And you're going to do 45 minutes. And I go, okay. And when I'm done, I go, okay, that didn't go well. But some of it was me, and some of it was this event was not right for comedy.
Yeah.
These people were, I did an event recently where people were drinking a lot. It was a bit like a celebration of funds raised throughout a year. And it's great. And I was glad to do it and help out. It was a worthy cause, but they probably should have just hired a band or some, you know, something.
Right,
just,
the medium that they're choosing for entertainment.
So I give myself a little bit of a break on it and be like, if I could only have been better comedian, like there's nothing I could have done different. I still did fine, but it was just a different environment. But yeah, I have been in situations early on, especially where I go, oh man, I'm not ready for this, or I always say my jokes aren't, or my jokes a tall enough ladder. to get me out of this hole,
yeah.
You know, that they've, sometimes it's a hole they've dug. Sometimes it's a hole just because the event is so big in scale. And you just hope you're big enough. I got thrown in front of some big crowds though early on, and that was part of, it's like trial by fire.
Yeah.
And you find out, you know, we have a room here in town. Zany's is our comedy club in Nashville. And I always like it because I call it an honest room. You know, you can really find out if you have something there. If you get laughs there, you have something. And if you don't get laughs there, you probably should work on it.
Yeah.
There's very few rooms like that, though. Sometimes you get really skewed data from a room. And I know church can be that way, too. Like, where you go, like, I was watching you when you were preaching Sunday, and you had a couple of really funny lines or a couple of really poignant lines. And I was looking around to see if people were leaning in. And I was like, I wonder if John gets rattled if they don't lean in when he expects them to lean in. It would be hard.
Rattled's a strong word. I think I struggle a lot right now with that part. There's this mixing in modern culture of the pastor delivering a message being on the same terms as an entertainer.
Yeah.
By terms, I mean we're on a stage that looks just like a stage a comedian perform on, or a band. It is a stage comedians perform on. And
right.
We have the same stage lighting. We have the same mics. We have the same live stream feed. We have, like, we're, you know, it's hard then for me and for them. Like, yes, I want them to lean in
right
at that spot, but I also
to go like now we're not performing anymore. Now this is the part where we do this.
Right.
To get them to change their expectations is almost unfair.
Yeah.
Because you've put them in that same place.
Well, modern evangelicalism, you know, and not just, I mean, even modern Protestantism.
We'll edit all this out.
Yeah. Protestantism. I got this. You know, I've toyed with the idea of moving more like some of our more liturgical brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And moving the podium, whatever that may be, to the side stage. Like,
okay.
There's a lot of traditions where the minister speaker does not stand.
It's like
at
a
the
lectern
center.
Off to the
and it's the usually the what we would call the communion table, but you know the elements of the Lord's Supper or the Eucharist that's at the center, so that there is a you know, here's the thing: you can downplay symbolism all that you want, and I agree with that, but they generally mean something. And so you are saying something by the way you structure your stage. I'm not saying by having a speaker in the center of the stage. I do this.
You're
every
saying
week.
That I'm the center of attention or whatever.
Right. I'm not saying that we're somehow trying to eclipse the value of Christ there or whatever, but there is something to be said for you do condition people.
Yeah.
For what you condition people by the way that you stage things or by the way that you say things. And so there's this, you know, would someone get it?
Yeah.
Would they be like, you know what, I today have now, and I would probably just tell them,
yeah.
But now I understand that Jesus is the center. I mean, like, we still would want to boil down and sort of reduce, you know, a little bit.
Like, if you move to the side, all of a sudden people would be like, I wonder why he's off to the side.
Right. You tell them why, even, would they be distracted
by that,
from what you're actually saying?
Or like,
now?
Is he saying that everyone that is in the center now is not in God's will because he figured it out and moved to the side?
Right.
I mean, it's a statement on all those other people.
Right. And then they'd be probably concentrating on what kind of tribe now am I a part of? And is it the tribe I want to be a part of?
Yeah.
Even if they took it right and they said, well, he's trying to mesh with liturgical tradition. Therefore, I don't want to be meshed with liturgical tradition. So now I'm, you know, is this a evangelical church? Is this a Baptist church? Is this a Pentecostal church? It's like everyone wants to know, is this a Bible believing church? Like, we get so many questions like that.
What about what side that you chose to move the lectern to? That could be the side political.
Well, is it right, stage left?
It's right. Or is it?
Or is it just right and left?
Or my perspective of what's right and left. Yeah.
Oh, what
yeah.
if I just move it a little bit to the left? Is that going
to
be too much?
Even that kind of drift is unacceptable to me, John.
Or a little bit to the right. That's funny. That's funny. What kind of statement are you trying to make? It's like, dude, I'm just trying.
Yeah.
Like, I'm always fascinated by I'm reading a book called Misreading Scripture with Western Eyes. It's been out since like 2012. And it's had a sequel, which actually I saw the sequel. I was like, I've been meaning to read the first one forever. So I bought both of them.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating as he's talking about, like, the lenses. Like, he's like, this is not really a book about reading scripture as much as it's a book about reading yourself.
Yeah.
because you don't realize, no one can realize.
Well, even the Bible talks about that it kind of, the Bible reads you. It divides truth.
Right.
It's this two-edged sword. So like the Bible is kind of reading us and our perspective and our biases as we read it, if we're doing it right. And sometimes we go, no, my interpretation is the right one. And we right. marry ourselves to that.
Well, you can't help but interpret
yeah.
the Bible through the only lenses you have. Mm-hmm. So you at least have to know what they are.
Right.
Like if you could, you don't have to know, but if you, so there's a lot of things we take away. And he just had a couple examples early on, like the church at Laodicea, which is where the whole you're lukewarm scripture comes in Revelation. I wish you were hot or I wish you were cold. And he talks about he visited the city mm-hmm. of Laodicea. And
which is lovely this time of year.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I've heard.
I'll tell you. But there's two neighboring cities within sight distance. One, Colossae at the time, hadn't been excavated, but one was known for their, one's still known today for their hot springs,
uh-huh.
like hot natural springs, which I've done in Iceland and stuff. You go and, you know, it's all this very earthy benefits to your skin and health and other things. And another was kind of known for like this ice cold pure water sort of out of the mountains. And so the city of Laodicea didn't really have a natural water source. And so there were aqueducts they had built.
Yeah.
So they have water coming from both places probably to their city. And by the time it got there, whether it was hot from one place or cold from the other, it was probably lukewarm. So the Laodiceans had a special sort of recognition of what lukewarm water was.
Right.
And so it probably, but in a revivalist informed culture like ours,
right? It just means you're not holy enough for God.
Right. We got
to
keep.
If you're not holding to the standard of holiness, then God's mad at you.
Yeah. It's a very like, how much of church for us is about that? We got to keep these people. Well, think about the words we use. We got to keep them on fire for God. And it's a.
So what? So you're saying that like the author's intent could have meant like about like our usefulness. Like
And he makes a good point. It's like, hey, I'm not going to tell you everything we're not going to tell you the two authors. We're not going to tell you everything we necessarily think it could mean through non-Western viewpoints. Mm-hmm. That's really not what this book is about. It's about giving you the lenses and then you go study scripture differently now. But I mean, his point is like, you think about how, but he didn't go this far, but I think about how, like I struggled with that scripture as a kid, mm-hmm. as a young adult, you know?
Right, fear of being lukewarm or whatever.
Yeah, God's going to spew you out of his mouth. And it very well could have been, maybe, I mean, all of this is metaphorical to some extent, but what if like it meant something to them? That's the whole point. Like it meant something to them differently than to us. And the takeaway may be similar, but it might have had as much to do with, hey, how... Guys, y'all know lukewarm water is not as useful as cold or hot.
Yeah.
Like, you know that. It's not as tasty. It's not as useful. So, like, basically your Christianity is not really – what was the word he used? I think it's not really outstanding in the sense of it's not making a difference either way.
Yeah.
Like, the way that you're living this faith is so middle ground. It's not really very useful to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to like in the second book, they have is misreading scripture with individualistic eyes. Well, I'm really struggling with that.
You're
Johnny.
Killing it today,
I'm a public speaker. But that whole concept of everything, you know, the Bible's written to collective cultures.
Right.
And we don't have much of a.
Well, what speaks to Americanism is we're individualistic.
Right. Everything for us is.
It's part of what capitalism is. It means like.
Yeah.
Hey, if there's not a place for you, go start a place.
Right.
Build your own table.
And even in Christianity, I mean, even, you know, with the Reformation, it's a very much, we now use the language, and I believe this language, and I think this language is scriptural. I'm just saying, though, we emphasize it on a level, but it's to the exclusion, possibly, of the community.
Yeah.
And that is that, hey, I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That's what all this is about. Yeah. And it is. But the backdrop and context of much of the Bible is being written to a group of people, not to an individual.
Yeah, I remember hearing that when I was a kid, preached more than once. If there was nobody else on earth but you, Jesus still would have died for you. And I believe that that's probably true, but it also kind of makes the gospel about you without meaning to.
Right.
It's like the point is, it wasn't just the sin of me. It was the sin of the world. And Jesus died to defeat sin and death.
But somehow it feels diminished.
Yeah.
When you say when you're a part of a group, it feels diminished.
Yeah, you make it about you. You make it bigger and smaller somehow. It's like you've made it worse, invariably worse.
Yeah. Because we don't know how to be a part of a group.
Yeah. Well, and we saw that. I mean, we talked about that at length, and I mean, it's so funny to go back and listen to the old episodes. And there's some I was like, ugh. Like, I thought about that with pandemic episodes because everybody was wrong about the pandemic like 20 times each. But I do think one thing we were right about is it really showed our collectivism was really lacking.
Yeah.
And culturally, that's borne out. Like, the more collective cultures did better during the pandemic than the people who said, it's me versus the world and I'll get through it and I don't care about the next person. For whatever side you chose to be on, we need each other and we're built to be in community. And when you ignore that to the deference of everything, like, you're going to have a harder time getting through a crisis.
It's interesting too, because wasn't it, I forget who came out and said, what we should have said to everyone was masks protect you.
Yeah.
And they thought it sounded more noble and true also to say, wear your mask because it protects your neighbor. And it was the worst thing in American culture to say because we hate our
neighbor. We hate our neighbor. Yeah.
So if you just would have said this will help you, then you probably would have skipped a lot of the controversy.
Yeah. Our neighbor's the problem. That's the thing. It's like, if everybody was just like me, America would be okay.
And the truth is, it was going to help both of you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not making a mask statement. I'm sorry, guys. I'm way past that now.
Yeah.
Your surgeons have been wearing masks for years.
John just took his mask off to start this recording, by the way.
I'm not wearing a mask anymore.
Louise.
Not bringing it back up again.
It's just fast. I'm just saying it's interesting. The collectivism is fascinating.
It is. And we didn't have all the information at the time, but the filter of individualism versus, a community, it backfired.
Yeah, I don't know if it exposed us as being like bad, but it exposed our biases.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, those lenses that we go, oh, that's not how I really think. Well, when you get into a crisis, you figure out how you really feel about things.
Yeah.
My buddy Tim Hawkins, he talked about that with writing. He'd say, I love writing jokes because I find out how I feel about stuff.
Yeah.
I never really had anybody say that. I was like, that's really interesting. Like, if I write 5 jokes about guns, by the end of those 5 jokes, I go, I got an opinion on guns I didn't really think about, you know? It exposes it.
I have said that for myself in prose writing and in sermons, but like sometimes I need to, if I'm wrestling with something, the best thing for me to do is to write about it.
Yeah.
Because then I have to research. I have to like inform myself. I have to go challenge with other viewpoints. And by the end, I still may not want to use what I've written, but it has caused me to go through a process.
No one wants to use what you've written.
Johnny, I think that the market bears that out.
Don't get me started on the market.
I will say this is not a shameless plug for me because it really is, but I'm hearing I'm reading a lot of reviews on Beth and Jeff McCord's book, More Than Your Number, that I, helped to write. And I'm telling you, the exciting thing about the reviews there, and Jeff and I were texting, is that the people writing the reviews are getting it.
Because
it's a complex, it sort of meshes some ideas from therapy into both gospel and Enneagram takeaways, And so you were worried it might be a little too heady and complex, to self-apply. But you have to have a professional therapist in order to do these kinds of things, And man, it seems as if it's not that. People are like, okay, yeah, this is, very, very helpful. And so when you do are a part of something that is practical and useful.
Yeah.
For someone like me, I'm always like, wow, I can't believe that happened, because I just assume, I just wrote too many words.
I think you assume that you're over people's heads because you're that smart.
No, I don't. No.
John,
I think the really smart people are able to boil it down better.
No, that's true. That is a real skill.
Yeah, I don't.
That's kind of what the original vision, I think, was for TED Talks.
Uh-huh.
Was, let's talk about something big, a big concept, and let's see if we can find speakers that'll boil it down.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard thing. If you find somebody that's really good at that, man, it's a whole game. It's a game changer as a skill.
I, this morning, was thinking, you're going to laugh, because I've been working on a proposal now on the side for this entire year, basically.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest thing I've ever tried to write. And it's one of those, like, I wouldn't say it's pie in the sky. It could be written. It's historical biography.
It's called Pie in the Sky.
It's called Pie in the Sky. It's about the guy who invented the pie.
It's a children's book.
Archimedes. At any rate, I don't know. But it's but I find myself, it sounds very pretentious.
Yeah.
the way I'm writing, but the books I read like this, I love. I mean, they're that way.
No, there's a time for that. There's a time for flowery, and we've kind of gotten away from that. I mean, I have friends who talk about that, about how, like, what was it, modern language in Shakespeare's time? Everybody's using like 6,000 words, and now it's like 200 words.
Yeah,
that we use every day. The average person uses. So, like, there's a time and a place to, like, not let language just slip away.
Well, I did a workout on one of my favorite historians' new book last night on their prologue, because the sample I'm putting in here is part prologue at least, and it's an 8,000 word prologue.
Okay,
like, just so you know, that's, I'd say, the most chapters. I mean, that's probably a full chapter size for a pretty big book. And the book itself, just the content, just the back notes section is almost as big as the book, the actual content. It's like almost like half notes from research in the back. And for his book, and but the actual just words he'd written, I do word studies on a book. So you count the number of words per line.
Okay.
You do like four or five lines to kind of find an average. I average about 10.5 words per line. You count the number of lines on a page.
Right.
And so that is 32 on every page. That's standard. And then you do the number of pages in, you know, of writing, and you multiply those three numbers.
Is there a program that can find out how many unique words you're using? Because that'd be the real question, right?
Oh.
How many unique words?
Like words that aren't repeated.
And then how many 50-cent words are among those?
Listen, if you've never read Ron Chernow, who wrote Hamilton and Grant, bro, you want to talk about 50-cent words. We're talking like $5 words.
Yeah.
In fact, it's so much fun for me. It's such a nerdy thing to say. Like, I do. I spend time looking up words.
Yeah.
And putting them into one note.
I used to do that as a kid. I'd read the dictionary.
Well, I read his words and how he used them. I'm like, okay, I know what he... I get it.
Yeah.
And I would have never used that word. You know, like, a word came out today that I was writing, and I had to go look it up because it was somewhere... That's why you read.
Oh, right.
Somewhere,
it came out of your...
It came out. I was like, oh, I want to use this word. Does that fit? And I made it... It did fit. I wanted to make sure I knew it exactly. I was like, oh, it was Well, I'm not going to say what it was because it sounds so pretentious. But you know, like, it may not stay in the edit. But what I really want right now, I think I want a writer.
Like, you want a writer for you.
Yeah. Well, okay. You know what we call that in the biz, Joni?
I don't.
We call that a sweetener.
Okay.
And so, like, there is, I've had publishers before. Like, I wrote one book that was like a novel.
Okay.
It was based on a true story because we thought a movie's being made. And so I wrote it very, like, I created characters to add in. We put all that in the introduction, like, hey, we're going to tell a story that has some really delicate matters or some things we need to protect in people. Mm-hmm. So we're going to make this work, you know.
Yeah.
But all this is real.
Yeah.
But we'll let you know what's not, kind of thing. And so, but I got a chance to kind of write that fiction side a little bit.
Yeah.
And they hired a sweetener.
Yeah.
That's someone who went through, and basically all he did was shore up like the first page of each. When I really went back and looked, he kind of shored up and made a little more concise the first page of each chapter.
Was it the little guy from the Dr. Pepper commercials?
The sweet one. Little sweet. Man, that guy cracks
me. He had a gigantic can.
It is so, what a funny concept.
That's great. What's funny about that is, you know who that is, right?
No.
That is, what is his name? Justin
Pepper.
No.
And he went to med school.
Justin from season one of American Idol.
What?
Yeah. What's his last name? I can't even remember. Kelly. So Kelly won. Kelly Clarkson won.
Uh-huh.
Then there was Justin, and I can't remember his name. The people are screaming at the radio right now. But he went on to do acting roles and other things and, you know, made some music projects. But now he's a little sweet.
Wow.
Yeah. That's his...
So funny.
Yeah.
I love it when someone can be...
Oh, it's great. I think it's such a cool, a cool second act. And those took off and they're funny. And he's really funny in them.
He's very funny.
Anyway, so that's your sweetener. Let me tell you what, you know, there's sort of sweetening in comedy as well.
Okay.
It's when you finish a project and let's say you've been doing these jokes on tour for months and months and months and they're killing you. Have your hour and you get in front of a crowd and you've got tape rolling and now the audience is a little flat. Mm. And you go, we just spent 50 grand to shoot this. What are we going to do? They come in and they sweeten it. They ramp up the laughs or they add laughs from other areas of the show or they double and triple.
Okay, so there's not someone you bring in to get the crowd hype.
No.
What do you call that guy?
There's like a, well, I don't know.
Like a
there's a warm up guy, like a warm up comic like would do for
a, when you go to a club, you're either featuring, headlining,
or you're host, or MC.
Okay. MC, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, when I did my taping, I had my buddy Marty come in, and he did the whole thing where he gave the crowd directions,
right?
And we did get some sample laughs because we knew I didn't think I was going to use them, and we didn't. We didn't sweeten my special. Yeah. I'm not saying that just to say it, but we didn't.
You heard it here, guys.
I'm talking about sweetening. I don't want people like, oh, that's why Johnny's clips always have laughs in them, because clearly he's terrible. No, I don't do it, but we did do a thing where you get the crowd laughing. Let's do a big laugh, and then Marty go like, let's do a laugh where you're almost offended at the end. You don't want to be laughing, but you're laughing. He'll do like eight different kinds of laughs. Marty's just been doing this a long time, and he knows. And he did that so we would have that just in case. But also, I like doing it because it gets the crowd laughing. It makes them exercise that muscle. Yeah. And it's also kind of funny to do because it's so different. Right. Like somebody telling you to laugh on cue, it's a weird emotion and a weird action. So I think just doing that makes people a little like more likely to laugh when something funny is said. So I like doing it if I'm doing a taping. And I probably would have Marty do it again because he was so great at it.
Yeah.
He was just funny, and he did it like a substitute teacher, and he was just very snarky about it, and people were just, you know.
He's a funny guy.
More
and,
at ease.
And he's good at, again, he's a coach.
Yeah.
You know, so like
but I know a lot of people that do that. They go, let's get our laughs. And they'll do like 5 minutes of laugh here, get a big laugh. Let's do a laugh with an applause at the end. Now let's do the applause first and fade in. And then you'll hear those on the special.
Wow.
You'll be like, oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, when you used to hear the canned laughter at like an I Love Lucy show or something back when sitcoms were taped like that.
Yeah.
You'd hear like the same laugh cough guy like four times in the show, and you'd be like, all right, that was cut and paste.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some, I can't remember what show it was. There's someone I recognized the same laugh over and over again. It may be a old Andy Griffith shows or something. Like you can. You
Did know. I ever tell you when we went to, so Marty got invited to go to New York. He was promoting his special. And he hired a publicity firm. So they go, hey, we got these opportunities. You can go. And he had a friend who was executive producer of Fallon at the time, who's not anymore. But he went to school with the guy and played Little League with the guy. So he goes, hey, while you're in New York, come here. We were going to like American Bible Institute, which had offices in Manhattan. And Marty was going to do like a quick interview with them, a sit down, because they had these cool offices. And they shot this show there every day, kind of like the Today Show. And Marty would interview and talk about his comedy special. And then we'd go to Fallon that night. So I go, I want to go. So I kind of totally glommed on to this trip with Marty, and I'm going to go to New York City with Marty. He goes, okay. So we went. We're staying in this tiny, you know, hotel. It was $300 a night, and it was literally the door opened into the bed. Like, it was tiny. I was like, man, New York's a different place, like Manhattan. But anyway, we go to Fallon that night, and it's a tiny studio. And it was the night Derek Jeter hit his last – it was Derek Jeter's last game where he hit the little blooper and won the game on his last hit. And so Derek Jeter was on the show that night. We didn't know who was going to be on. We were just like, they were just putting the guests. We just knew we were going. And so we're there, and Marty is so funny. Like, he kept doing this laugh. Like, Fallon would do his monologue, and then Marty would go, ha-ha! Like that. And then I kept looking over him like, what are you doing? And after a while, I realized he's trying to get his laugh on the tape because we're going to go watch this later tonight, and he's going to... And I'm telling you, John, they edited. And whoever is editing the Fallon show,
they got it out.
They caught them all. Everyone was gone. I think he coughed one time. I was like, dude, some people do anything to get on TV. He could be like, yeah, I was on Fallon that one time. But it made me like, so I always, whenever Marty's talking about that, I always do that weird laugh. Like,
Oh my gosh, so funny.
They were like, hey, whoever's over there in section B, get that guy's laugh out of here. Move the microphone.
That's great, man. Yeah. That's great. We're thinking about a trip back to New York.
Oh, yeah. It's great.
Yeah. We're contemplating a little short Christmas trip maybe before Christmas.
That'll be fun. Well, Christmas is fun, yeah, because of the energy of the city. And there's the garbage smell is gone.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I usually bring my own garbage.
In summer, it's the hot garbage. In the winter, it's the frozen garbage.
Yeah.
You know, behind the businesses that you're walking past. You're like,
yeah, right. There was a garbage.
Oh, thing. Scaffolding and
but
garbage.
You know what, Johnny? One man's garbage is another man's garbage.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. It was...
New York's fun. It's an intimidating city to think about living there.
Yeah.
Because I would think it would just be, like, really intimidating to think of the expense and the... Just, like, whoa. But, man, visiting, yeah, there is an energy and it's fun. There's just so much to do. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah, we may just depends. But
of course, you're a Broadway guy. You got to go to all the plays and.
Yeah, you know, again, we're ruined a little bit. Like we get third row Hamilton on Broadway.
Yeah.
Like I've seen a few shows since, you know, different things, and it's all great. But like it was the Lifetime type experience. Like to me, the best show written in our lifetime.
Yeah.
And it was great.
That's high praise, John.
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling
Hamilton,
you.
Hamilton, not a sponsor.
Yeah, it was fascinating. So again, we watched it on TV. You went to Teabag. You saw it. It was great.
It's great.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Oh boy. Here we go.
No, it was great.
But it can't possibly live up.
Well, Lauren, I was talking about last night.
Listen, what you thought Hamilton was, Johnny, I don't know. I'm not saying I feel sorry for you, but.
You just can't know.
Yeah. You just don't know what we saw. You don't have any. You don't know what to compare it to. What you are is a rube.
You.
You're a naive.
I.
You think you're a theater fan.
Lauren, I was talking about last night. It was her birthday. I took her out for her birthday.
Yeah.
And we were talking about our first cruise. Mm-hmm. And that thing, like you can't, you can never replace a great first experience. If you have a bad first experience, yeah. Sure. But like it was our first cruise, 10-year anniversary. Sadie was so little that she could be with the grandparents and wouldn't even know that we were gone, you know, really.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not worried.
She knew. She called me. She was upset.
She couldn't even, yeah.
She was pretty upset.
And, you know, as long as you bring home a gift, who cares, you know? And it could be a $10 whatever from the gift shop, but from the airport. But, you know, we did Celebrity.
Yeah.
I mean, have you done a Celebrity cruise?
No.
So it's like upscale Royal Caribbean. It was, I think, 8 days, 7 nights.
Yeah.
And.
It'd be weird if it was. 7 days, 8 nights. They were like, "What are we going to do that?"
You went into the what do we do that Bermuda Triangle for a while. Yeah,
and you go into the hold of the ship for one of the days. But you get to stay in the room at night, though. Well, this feels weird. No, it's just that's how we booked
that's
it.
That's how it's labeled. And like we were in the spa, section of the ship. We had you had the main dining room, but we upgraded and did private dining at our own private dining
room. I feel like we talk
room.
A lot about our very expensive vacation.
Well,
on
this is
show.
The one. I have not done one like this since. I'm still paying for it.
Yeah.
And but like it was just us, and I'm telling you, there was just something. It's hard, and I've enjoyed cruising since. But nothing's ever been like that experience. And Laura and I were like, I guess. Sort of.
Do you think if you went back and did it again, that it would be the same? Or
I don't
still,
know.
You built up in your mind.
That's
to
the
where,
point. Yeah. We were postulating, like, is it possible to recreate an inaugural experience?
You know what I was thinking the other day is about kids in your neighborhood who had nicer toys than you.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, do you remember this kid? The kid who got a go-kart or whatever?
I didn't live in a very nice neighborhood.
But were there kids who had things that you didn't have?
No.
Like a nicer bike? Or you're like, no, I was that
no,
kid.
No, well, we grew up in the country at first, and all of us were just kind of, you know, just, I'd say.
You're just rubbing sticks together. And
yeah, I mean.
Banging bricks together.
And then when we moved, this is awful. When we moved, I lived between two churches.
Yeah.
So, like, I didn't have kids next door. My school's right down the road. So, like, my friends were in the neighborhood across the street some.
And then you became a pastor. Because you live between?
Coincidence?
Yeah.
What
are you living between?
Come on, guys.
Listener.
What you live between is what you become. One of those churches was a church on a hill, and another was not. Now,
one was
us,
built on the sand, and one was...
Guys, a storm came through.
Yeah.
My house is the only thing that stood between those two churches.
I saw that house. It was not that great of a house. That house would have been in trouble. I remember staying at your house, and you had this dog, and I'm a dog person. I go to pet the dog, and a whole family at once goes, "No!" And I go, "What?" It was an outside dog. And you go, No. You'll get the smell of the dog on your hand. You won't be able to.
Sugar Bear was that dog's name. And Sugar Bear was the sweetest dog ever. But she had like a medically medically diagnosed skin condition.
It'd be weird if they prescribed a skin condition.
They gave it to her.
Hey, I you know what you need to do?
Put this cream on and you'll stink real bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, she was great. But
yeah.
You had to just like pet maybe just her head sometimes. But the stench would get into your hands.
Poor sugar baby.
Laura has the same story. She started a pet dog.
I thought you were going to say, Laura's got the same thing. I can't.
I thought this would be a time to talk about it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, she went to pet the dog the first time she came over to the house, and they were like, no, I mean, like, poor dog.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Poor Laura. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's just, it's so funny. Yeah, but I remember that story of like, but my neighbors, okay, I'm just saying this because we live in a cul-de-sac, and there's kids, families with kids all around us. And it's interesting watching, like, one family in two houses down from us. This kid comes out one day and he's driving the electric Jeep.
Okay.
You know, he's got his little Jeep, kid size Jeep.
Like a Power Wheels.
He's 3 years old, three, 4 years old.
Power Wheels.
And he's going, yeah. And he's going down, you know, and they're with him. Like, she's walking behind him. But it goes pretty fast. I'm like, well, this is cool. And then the next day or 2 days later, I see he's got like a convertible.
What?
Yeah. And then I swear to you, there's like an SUV.
Was he in one of those clubs?
I don't know, but I think he's got like four or five. Like, one Power Wheels isn't enough for this kid, or wow. The parents just projecting.
Wow.
So I'm just thinking, I wonder what I would have thought of that kid when I was a kid, because, I mean, I was lucky to get whatever. I don't remember getting, we didn't have Power Wheels, you know, when I was a kid. No. A battery-operated thing
we got a real go-kart. And
did you really?
Yeah.
You were the go-kart kid?
Actually, we had a golf cart. And a go.
Oh my God.
Like, well, Dad would get old golf carts, fix them up. Like, it's a wonder that we would like.
Did you drive it on the road?
No, all around the yard though.
Yeah, yeah.
Like flip
you
it.
Try to ramp it.
We did
yeah.
Like, it's a wonder that we survived.
We built so many ramps for our bike, and there'd always be like, then you want to lay your friends out, jump your friends. There's always that one friend that's like, I'm not being the end of this. Like, jump two kids, I'm not being the third kid, Evel Knievel.
It's dumb.
Yeah, now a bike comes down on your chest.
Yeah, like you could really be seriously injured.
Mm-hmm.
I think I remember one time my brother or someone, like I was on foot, and they were chasing me on a golf cart, like through the yard. I remember this. Like, and so you learn, I became very agile.
Do you think this is why you're not great at golf? It's some like PTSD.
I mean, it was funny at the time. Also,
buried trauma.
I think I knew if I got run over by this golf cart, this would be bad.
Yeah.
So I think he probably wouldn't have really run me over.
Well, you guys know my golf cart story from 4 years ago or so. I think I told it on the podcast years and years ago, but we were coming down a hill. We were on this course, me and my buddy Brian Bates. He's driving. And then it was like, stay on the path. But we were like, what? There's a bunch of cart. You can see the trails. But it's going straight downhill. And so we got off the path. We're going down to where our shots were, our first shot. And we start going so fast down this hill that he can't slow it down. He's braking as hard as he can. And then he just kind of slams the brakes, and the cart starts going sideways down the hill.
You know you're going to flip.
And it's on my side, and I see it's going to flip. So I jump out of the cart.
But wouldn't it hit you if you jump out?
I jumped out to try to get clear, and I barrel rolled out of the way. Well, when I jumped out, the weight shifted. I was 300 pounds then. The weight shifted. The car goes, it snapped up and didn't tip, because it was tipping partly because of my weight, I guess. But we were going like sideways down the hill too. So all that said, I jump out, I land wrong on my toe, broke my big toe, and I rolled away. And then I'm just like groaning, and I tried to play through, and I couldn't, and I ended up going home, and then I went and got a splint and a little boot. But, Bates always blamed me for that. He was like, you jumped out. Everything was going to be fine. Like, we don't know what would have happened, but it was tipping over. When I jumped out, it was tipping
over.
You
can feel the tippage.
Yeah. It was going to be bad. And
we got some pretty traumatic golf cart stories here.
And this explains so much. Like, a lot of people would say we're not good at golf just because we don't play golf enough and we're just not athletic and we're bad at sports in
general.
Those
would seem like, I guess,
but I think you can't discount the emotional factor of being traumatized by a sport that you otherwise would love.
Yeah. You know what? And when I was in New York in Buffalo this last year playing golf with Reggie, I really enjoyed myself. And I played pretty well for me.
Did you have a cart?
Yes. But I kind of vowed, you know, would it be good for me mental health-wise?
What's that?
I want to play some more golf when I get home. You know how many times I've played?
No.
None. Like, we could be not wasting our time doing this right now. We could be out on the golf course.
This isn't a waste,
John. Sorry, listener. I'm sorry I said
that. Don't be that.
No. I'm just saying, though, you know who's not invited me to play?
No.
You. and it hurts a little
bit.
We can
go play today if you want.
No, today's no good for me. Actually, it's very cold today. I don't know if, listener, I'm wearing, which this is great. I told you, I came home from the beach, and on my desk, I preached about this Sunday.
I know, I saw it. It was a huge point in your sermon about your fingerless gloves.
Tears were falling. But I came home, and there was two pairs of fingerless gloves on, which I write with a lot, on my desk, and a note from Andrew and Julie, from Julie, that said, "Hey, Andrew didn't want your hands to get cold when you're writing your next book, so here you go." And I thought, man, I felt seen, you know? It was just a little token, but they're really nice. They're H&M gloves, and very, like, I would never buy something this upscale.
So, well, no, you're broke because you've been on a celebrity cruise.
That was a long time ago. Okay, I want to... Nah, I can't.
What?
Okay.
We need to go on vacation together. Why have we never been on vacation together?
I don't know.
We should do it. What are you afraid of?
I'm not afraid of anything.
Well, there is a vacation vibe that couples have.
Are you...
You know what I'm saying? Like, couples have a vibe on vacation. Like, some couples are like, let's not waste time. Let's get up and do stuff. And then some couples are like, we're here because we're exhausted. We're going to sleep till 11, and then we'll see you guys at the buffet or whatever.
So I don't...
And you might be annoyed by that if we're that couple.
I don't sleep till 11 on vacation, yeah. But we do get up and then go to our relaxation spot.
Yeah.
So, like, we won't stay... We might, we'll sleep in, but like usually.
You hurry up to go down and relax.
By 11, we're on the beach.
Yeah.
Like, no, man, that's okay. We spend 11 till whenever on the beach now, you know. So I might fall asleep again at the beach, but we're not just going to, you know, if we're there, we could, you know, that's the weird part. Like, we could, if we wanted to stay in the bed, we could just stay at home. It's like, no, but there, people require you to go to jobs in order to eat and stuff.
Right.
Here.
Vacation's fun.
Yeah.
You can't live on the mountaintop, though, John. You've got to get back down into the city.
Oh, my goodness. I think people it's the valley, need you. Isn't it?
Is it? No, it? How do you go?
Is there a...
I don't know.
I don't know.
There's a city in the valley, in my scenario.
I think you just wrote a Southern Gospel song. There's a city in the valley.
Yeah.
I don't. Are you going to keep going?
No. There's enough Southern Gospel music in the world.
I'm not
saying it's bad. I'm saying we have enough.
And by the way, poo-poo...
Thanks for making it all. We have it.
I want to remind you that poo-poo is a real word.
Yes.
I just found it in another historical biography.
Yes.
P-O-O-H-P-O-O-H.
Yeah.
I want to know its etymology. I think I looked it up, but I want to know.
I think it's from guys going...
You think?
It's the sound. It's like onomatopoeia.
Oh. Wow. You're just dropping them today,
You know what I'm saying?
I am looking it up right now.
It's from guys going... It's that.
It means to express contempt or impatience.
Yeah.
And it's...
Because I don't think someone actually went, poo-poo! Like, I don't... You know, they don't say it.
First known use would be 1823.
Okay.
And now I'm going to attempt... Usually it has a word history, but I'm not finding it. I just know it's 1823. Huh.
I remember there was a story about a really condescending bear called Winnie the Pooh-Pooh. He did not have as many friends.
Yeah, he... That poor Winnie the Pooh-Pooh. Originated in the late 18th century as a reduplication of the word poo, which was a common expression of disgust. Some authors also suggest the term originated as a representation of the act of spitting in sign of contemptuous rejection. Poo-poo.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, listener... I'm trying to figure out where you're going with your segue.
We appreciate you not poo-pooing us.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? And
thanks for being on board.
It means a lot. Thanks to all of you who are patrons.
Yeah, we appreciate our patrons. That's so great. And we're actually trying to figure out something cool for our patrons. We need to do another group call. We want some more input from them because the show is getting ready to have a cool announcement, and we want to know, like, what do you want to see more of? What do you want to see way less of?
Johnny.
Not to put too fine a point on it. But so we need to do that. We need to set that up for our patrons. So if you want to get in on that.
Email Johnny at johnnyw.com.
Yeah, that's a good spot for it. And you can also go to talkaboutthatpodcast.com, find all of our archived episodes, listen to those, and get to our link trees. That's where you can find out our social media. That's where you can find out where to follow us and see what's going on. I got a ton of tour dates coming up. You can get tickets and information on all those.
Yeah.
John's got new books he's working on. A couple of books that are fresh out.
Yeah, new book out.
He's got this one behind me that you can go ahead and go get a copy of.
Yeah.
Amazon.com.
Yeah. You can also, though, the latest book, we talked about More Than Your Number with Jeff and Beth McCord, but there's another book by a guy named Pat Bradley that I wrote on called Born for Rescue. And it actually is coming out right now. And it's, I'm telling you, some of the craziest stories I've ever written.
Yeah.
Like, it just traveled the world. If there's a disaster, his organization, Crisis Aid, is like, they're like first on the ground. And mm-hmm. they have, they work with, you know, UNICEF and other organizations to sort of, you know, have those specifications that they have that right to be there.
Right.
So, yeah, check it out. Born for Rescue, and it's I'm telling you, it's worth it. The book opens with him being in Pakistan about maybe 6 or 7 weeks after September 11th.
Oh wow, okay.
Driving a truckload of food, he's trying to get to a refugee camp, and a truck pulls up with about 7 guys with AK-47s who are Taliban fighters, and they get out and surround him. And that's where we open the book. True story. I was going to leave it there.
Sheesh. To let them. That's what you call a cliffhanger in the radio biz.
You're going to have to buy the
book. That's a tease.
Now. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to get my copy.
There you go. Johnny's like, wow, I must know what happened.
I need to know. I wish I could read. This is a bummer.
Yeah, it's sad that Johnny doesn't read. So.
That's okay.
But, hey, yeah, send us questions, comments, topics you want us to talk about. They always mean a lot. Go leave a review, man. We appreciate it when you do that. It means a lot. And, we're excited about the next season of the podcast. We kind of keep, you know, alluding to that, but there is some new things coming. This is episode
27
or 8.
Oh wow.
That's a lot, you know. So we're gonna keep going for the moment until someone makes us stop. And please don't be that person, listener.
Don't
help us go another episode, just one episode at a time, bro.
Yeah.
If this only reaches one listener, person. We'll probably stop at that point.
So, yeah, that's not enough.
Yeah. So, anyway, but hey, we're not stopping this time because we're going to do it again next week. Huh?
Talk about that.
Hello, hello, Quinice Petway here, co-host of the Your Daily Bible Verse podcast. Are you someone who loves to take a deep dive into God's Word, one verse at a time, to explore His will for your life and desire to draw closer to Him? If that sounds like you, I'd love to invite you to head over to lifeaudio.com and search Your Daily Bible Verse to tune in and subscribe for daily inspiration, life application, and spiritual transformation through the in-depth exploration of God's Word.